more than two stops. To adapt to the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try to make smiles, to bring sight to the blind man. And sound to the left child, we will survive. It is time to be wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Journalist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. Interesting articles that you can read or download at later times and share with your friends. Also, check out the Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being posted in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and the diaspora. So check it out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight we have a special guest joining us, and he's been on the program on several occasions, talking about a series of lectures, a lecture series that will be hosted by Afrocentricity International. The Vice Sanuti at Afrocentricity International will be with us for the first maybe hour of the program, maybe hopefully hour and a half. Brother Owomali Africa will be joining us, and we'll be right back to get started with our conversation with our special guest after a few words from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot. How you doing there?
And where are you, sir?
Warm now, but dealing with the chill. Hey, Elliot, I'm like, they had me in, I want to say now, that nature, we used to say Mother Nature is with us. I don't know anymore who's controlling the weather anymore, but it had me with a couple coats on, I know that. But other than that, everything is fine. I guess because of the guests we have on tonight and what we're going to be talking about, and I mentioned it to you, always bearing my false mind to folks. I was listening to, went to the AI presentation by Dr. Obadeli Cambone, and I said to myself, I was listening to him, he's challenging my black card, you know, because Brother Cambone, it makes you really ask, how centered are you? And I really appreciate that as far as from a personal development. But it looks like we're with Brother Omawali is like he's set up a different host of topics to challenge people's black card.
Well, listen, if you remember, Richard, all of last year we were talking about the need. In fact, for a couple of years now, we've been talking about the need to establish think tanks in all of these areas where we dwell. It's necessary to have pertinent topics on the table that'll spur conversation and that should spark movement among our people. And when I say should, I'm not, maybe should is the wrong word, that will start movement among our people, whether it's 10 people or 10,000. It'll start some type of movement. I'm glad that Brother Omawali has started some of these conversations over there at Afrocentricity International. It's always been conversations there. But this centered lecture series that he's going to kick off next month, I think is very interesting. And let's bring our guest on to talk about that. Vice Sanudi for the Afrocentricity International in Philadelphia. Brother Omawali Africa is with us. Brother Omawali.
What's going on, Brother Rich, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I really can't complain. I'm blessed.
Listen, we want to get right into it, the lecture series. But first, the discussion today with Professor Bandalay Cambone, was that the start of the lecture series, or is it going to start in February?
So, this year, we decided to take a different approach to our general membership meetings that we have every first and third Sunday of the month. So if you've attended any of our meetings in the past for the general membership meeting, it was really like an open forum, you know, an open discussion where we would just collectively, you know, build on a topic, whether it be like a current event or just something that's happening in the African world. And we would just have like really an open discussion, open dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought, you know, strategically that our members could get more if we restructured our general membership program. So this year, we're just taking it in a different direction, right? So if you attend one of our general membership meetings, it'll either be a lecture, a workshop, or a presentation. So what we decided to do was that for the winter and early spring, we're going to put on a series of lectures at the Institute. Over the summer, we're going to have workshops, and then in the fall, you know, hit it back into the winter, we're going to be putting on presentations. So I guess like the difference between like a presentation and a lecture, right? If you think of like a lecture, like the one, you know, that Brother Rich attended today, you know, we bring somebody in to build on a topic, you know, that is impactful from an African-centered or Afrocentric perspective, right, from a Pan-Africanist perspective. To help increase our consciousness, right? So Dr. Obadeli Cambone, he lectured today on the difference between Ma'at and egalitarianism, right? But whereas though a presentation, you know, we're bringing somebody in that's a generalist just to present information to the community, meaning, you know, maybe we'll bring somebody in that, you know, has a specialty in, you know, starting businesses, right? We'll bring them in to talk about that. Maybe we'll bring somebody in who, I don't know, I'm just going off the top right now, but like the presentations is more so, they're not lecture specific, you know what I mean? It's more so information. Whereas though the workshops we're going to do this summer, they're going to be a bit more hands-on, you know what I mean? So we're trying to get Sister Beverly from All the Way Live to come in and do a workshop on, you know, world cooking, vegan cooking, right? Mm-hmm. So like, that's like the difference between like a lecture or a workshop and a presentation. So the one we had today was really just our first lecture of the year. And then I have a series that I'm doing called Strike Drum, The Political Awakening of African Consciousness. And we're kicking that one off on the 2nd of February. So it's 6 lectures that are going to be hosted during our general membership meeting this year.
Before we get into talking about some of the 6 ones that you'll be hosting, because I want you to kind of break down why you chose these specific 6 topics. Today's lecture, Egalitarianism versus Mayotte. Richard said it was very interesting because it challenged some of his beliefs and where he thought that he was in his development. I'll put it that way. Talk about it from your perspective. What did you think about the lecture? Who chose that particular topic? I think it was very interesting because it goes right to the heart of our people's mindset here and how we have to work on developing a new approach and a new mindset.
Yeah. Hold on 1 second, Brother Rich.
Kyrie, go away from the door, buddy. I'm on a phone call.
I'm sorry, I told you I got the older the kids here watching this.
Ain't no problem, man. You a family man. We understand.
All right, but so the topic today is funny. Like, Brother Obadeli and I have been building a relationship over the past few years. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is one that he has spoken on before. So what happened was towards like the end of last year, we were having some internal conversations at the chapter around the principles of hierarchy, you know. And this is, you know, for me personally, like that conversation is one that I've experienced, you know, within the community organizing in general. Like oftentimes when you go into the community, whether it be, you know, African-centered or Afrocentric organizations, there's always this notion or this argument that's put forth where people say, you know, hierarchy is anti-African. And what they mean by that is that, you know, hierarchy violates Ma'at. And, you know, there's a lot of assumptions, you know, when you make that statement, right? Like, so typically, The first assumption is that the concept of Ma'at is embodied in egalitarianism, and that's a falsehood, right? And then the second assumption is that we assume that, like, our social and political relationships should be organized based upon the principles of egalitarianism, right? Because we take egalitarianism to mean Ma'at. So I knew that Dr. Cambone had did presentations on this topic in the past, so I had reached out to him and asked him, like, hey, would you just be able to start our year off with a discussion around the difference between, you know, Ma'at and egalitarianism so that we can eliminate some of the confusion, but also speak, you know, to the importance of hierarchy, you know, in terms of us organizing ourselves for defense or for development or liberation. You know, what role does hierarchy play in that? And I just think that his presentation today was brilliant.
Mm. And, you know, for the listening audience or some that may not know, can you take a, you know, brief and define what is Ma'at and where did this term or concept come from?
Yeah. So, I mean, Ma'at comes from Kemetic society. You know, it's the bedrock, you know, of ancient Kemet, right? The philosophy or the concept of Ma'at, which is truth, justice, reciprocity, order, right, balance, right. These are the principles of Ma'at, and it's a way of organizing society to ensure that justice reigns supreme, right? Because the opposite of Ma'at is what's referred to as Isfet or chaos, right? So when chaos reigns supreme, our role as leaders within the community or as African people is that of working to restore, right, working towards the restoration of Ma'at, right, towards the restoration of justice. All right, so right now we exist, you know, globally in a state of Isfet or a state of chaos, you know what I mean? So working collectively to put African people, Black people, back in their right place within the global paradigm, meaning working to restore Ma'at or African sovereignty.
And one thing that and I say that challenge, because I guess it did come to the presentation with the notion of egalitarian as or communal, communal and egalitarian being synonymous, being communal social order. But one thing that I walked away with that I thought was important to understand is that the point of having, as Dr. Cambone makes it clear, of a Eurasian concept and how we kind of in our language perpetuate a Eurasian concept compared to an African concept, and that we have text that shows the African context of social order that may not be equal to what we perpetuate, even if we think that we're African conscious. And he used this series of texts to do that and showing that there was a, and I'm wrestling with terms, a hierarchical, or there was order. There had to be, and even to the quote unquote mythology, there is a someone who is sitting in the seat. So there is a structural understanding of order, and it is written in text that you can go to, and you don't, and it's different than making up or borrowing somebody else's conceptual framework, which may be used against us.
Agree. And I think, you know, what Dr. Cambone is trying to get us to do is to think more critically, right? You know, he said today that the equal sign will be the death of African people, right? Because what we typically try to do is we look at a phenomenon in Europe, and then we look for the equivalent in Africa, right? So we'll say, Europe has monarchy, right? So then we'll go and look for similar systems in Africa, and we'll label those as monarchy. And we'll say, well, if we look at the situation in Europe, okay, monarchy is bad, so similar systems on the continent are also bad, right? So it's this knee-jerk reaction where you get trapped in this European binary where you say, well, Europeans do this, and since they do it and it's bad, then that means that anything that I equate to that in African society is also bad. And like when you do that, you're really centering them in your analysis. You know what I mean? Like Dr. Mazama always say, you know, we don't exist on our own terms. We exist on borrowed European ones, right? So since we don't have any way to kind of like speak or articulate phenomenon from our worldview, we're always borrowing from their concepts and then trying to impose them on our reality. And that's something that cannot be done. And I think that that's really what he was challenging today.
Okay. Let's go to your lecture, sir, that you'll be hosting and starting on the 2nd of February at 1 p.m. over at the Afrocentricity International headquarters on Germantown Avenue, 5535 exactly, Germantown Avenue. The first lecture series that you'll be hosting, The Ethnic Cleansing of Black America and the Black Immigrant Paradox. Give us a little synopsis of that topic and why you chose that to be first.
Oh, man. So the title, like I like having controversial titles. You know what I mean? Because typically, you know, when people they see the title and they're like, what's that about? And then when they get to the lecture, like, you know, it's not what they thought it, you know, would be. But nevertheless, like I chose this particular topic because it's something that I've been wrestling with for some time now, and that is, how do you, okay, let me back up, right? So the entire series in general, right, Strike Drum, The Political Awakening of African Consciousness,
mm-hmm.
right? Strike Drum is, it's a battle cry, you know, the strike of the drum, right? It's a call to war, it's a call to action. But the political awakening of African consciousness, right, is what I'm looking to achieve with this lecture series. So basically, what does it mean to have a political awakening? Well, for me, a political awakening just speaks to the way that we analyze reality as African people. You know what I mean? Like, what lens do we view reality and situations, and how does that lens work in a way that we can kind of like operationalize our actions to help achieve our goals? And for me, that's really what I'm trying to bring to people. I'm trying to bring them a critical, you know, African-centered or Afrocentric lens through which to view phenomena so that they'll never be outmaneuvered by their enemies or by our enemies. And right now, I think the state of our consciousness is so reactionary and so emotional that we're easily manipulated and outmaneuvered by our enemies. So this entire lecture series is an attempt really to contextualize some of the movements or maneuvers that our enemy uses against us so that we can have clearer eyes to see them so that we can respond accordingly. You know what I mean? So that's really the purpose of this entire lecture series. So the first one, where I'm dealing with the ethnic cleansing of Black America and the Black immigrant paradox, that's getting into, without going into too much detail, because I want folks to kind of like attend the lecture series. Mm-hmm. But that's dealing with the fact that within, you know, here in America, there is a, you know, a documented history of an ethnic cleansing campaign against our population, right? People who were historically enslaved in America. And in discussing that, you have to address the ways that Black immigrant populations serve to cover those actions, and how certain things are strategic on the part of those people who are looking to you know, eliminate a certain population. And the reason why you have to do this is because the way things operate on the global scale, you know, certain moves that are made here in the West or in America are also made in other parts of the diaspora and also on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the ability to assess it properly here in America, then you won't be able to assess it properly anywhere you look. You know what I mean? So that's really what I'm going to be. My synopsis is probably not even giving it enough, doing it enough justice as to what, you know, the breadth of topics, you know, or the width of topics I'm going to be covering in that first lecture series, or that first lecture of the series. But it's going to be a good one, I'll tell you that.
But, you know, it's, Elliot, you know, and I want to jump in trying to create a flow. And since Brother Mawali is like trying to hold off so that we can attend and get the full logic of each presentation, which I can understand. It seems to be some kind of order to this, but I'm looking at the March 15th lecture, right? And which I'm, to my mind, kind of follows up in the point that you made, the synopsis, and like niggerism on trial.
Nigerianism.
Is that what it is? Oh, yeah, Oh, wait a minute. Hold it. Uh-oh. Yeah, I'll leave that alone. Stop. Nigerianism on trial. The deconstruction of a colonial identity. I don't think that was a Freudian slip. And I say that because Bro Mawali did a presentation that still sticks with me in dealing with Nigeria. So I don't know if this is a continuation of that, or which I thought was really good in being able to place Nigeria as a colonial system. And why? So
this is a update to that. And so what happened was, when I gave the first lecture, Nigerianism on Trial, back in August of 2018, the content was just too heavy. It was too much. So I ended up shortening the presentation. And if you recall, because Brother Rich, you attended that, it rained really, really, really bad when we gave that lecture. So, like, although we had, like, 30 people RSVP to attend, maybe, like, 8 folks showed up. Because it was, like, a monsoon outside during the day of that lecture.
Right.
But what I did was I took the material from that lecture and I updated it and made some modifications. And this time I'm going to give the second part where it says Nigerianism on Trial Part 2, where you're dealing with the corrupted seeds of Mama Africa, it gets to deal with the second part of the content that I wasn't able to give during the first time I gave the lecture. But it fits well within this particular series.
But, you know, Elliot, one thing that I don't know, I want the listening audience to know that I kind of, when it gets to looking at and trying to deconstruct or even to construct what's going on on the continent, and I see certain actions, I text brother or call brother Mawali to get his views, because he's another one that it seems that there is a little bit more hardcore or in the analysis. And I think it's really appropriate that we do have critical analysis as we look at, is the continent, is the leaders truly moving in the direction of African liberation from the state perspective and from a geopolitical perspective? And so when I ask him a question about, you know, say the leader of Rwanda, and then the state of Rwanda, and what it's going to me, it seems like positive indications, and not just Brother Mawali, but others say we need to be a little bit more skeptical. And so I ask, does this skepticism, does in this presentation as you deal with Nigeria, does it inform your thinking when we look at what's going on in other African countries, say even with the discussion that's going around the Francophone countries of whether to come off the CFA? Does that inform you? And how does that sort of listening audience continue?
So let me first say that Nigerianism, right, as a concept, is not something that is unique to Nigerians, nor is it unique to Africans on the continent. It's equally applicable, or colonial identity, should I say, is equally applicable to Africans throughout the diaspora. You know, I just use Nigeria or Nigerianism as the vessel through which to have the discussion, because at the time I had just completed like a very detailed, you know, encompassing review of Nigeria and its development.
And that's what I enjoyed. I have to say, Elliot, that's what I enjoyed about it. It was detailed and was encompassing.
Yes, but Nigerianism is not something to pick on Nigerians, right? It's just a term that I use to capture the concept of what I refer to as colonial identity. So really the lecture could have been Colonial Identity on Trial, but that name wouldn't, you know, be as much of a draw. But then to speak to the second part of your question, right, that geopolitical analysis or that analysis of the situation impacting African people, we're actually launching a podcast. We have a lot going on. I hope to address a lot of it during this interview tonight. But we're launching a podcast. I think it's going to be in March at the chapter. And the name of the podcast is going to be the African World Order Podcast, right? So the name African World Order, it's a play on words, right? A portion of it is inspired by the UNIA, right? Marcus Garvey had the Negro World, right? So we have African World, but after African World, we have the word order, right? So the African World Order Podcast. And so that name really is inspired heavily by the work of Dr. Marimba Ani, right, and her focus on sovereignty, right? And so the whole premise of this podcast is all around, it's centered around one question, right? And that question is a very simple one, is it good for African people, right? So no matter the subject that we're discussing, when we're discussing it, and we're bringing analysis to bear upon it. We're trying to answer that one question. Is it good for African people? And there's criteria by which we can assess if something is good. Does this phenomenon push African people towards unity? Does this phenomenon push African people towards sovereignty? And does this phenomenon push African people towards collective power by which they can confront their enemies on any field of battle, whether that be military, financial, economic, health, whatever it is? Like, does it push us towards that? And if the answer to those things is no, then you have to answer, then it's not good for African people. Right. You can't like straddle the fence, because like we have to be serious about what we're faced with. So that's the whole premise of the podcast. And I guess the reason why Brother Rich refers to me as a hardliner is because I'm really not much. I'm not moved by rhetoric and theatrics. You know, I see a lot of theatrics. I hear a lot of rhetoric, but I always look towards the actions and a lot of stuff I've seen before. You know, when you study struggle, when you study, you know, some of our past actions and how our enemies have responded, then you really start to see kind of like what's what and what's going to work and who's in it. You know, like Brother Rich, we were having this conversation recently where we talked about, you know, the road to liberation is like I-95. And there's a lot of exits along 95. Let's say that like the journey to liberation is I-95, but the destination is Florida. There's a lot of exits between Florida and Pennsylvania. You got some people who want to go on that journey with you, but they plan on getting off at Maryland. Like, they're not really trying to go, you know, past Carolina, right? Because for them, you know, their concept of liberation is they have access to economic opportunities. They're able to exist in a world where they can provide for their children. You know, they're able to, you know, just feel good and have life's comfort. Like, once they achieve that, you know, some people, they would be cool in slavery. They're like, listen, I had a good slave master. He fed me good. He clothed me good. He treated me nice. You know, what's better than that? Whereas the other people are like, no, we need to annihilate this entire plantation system, you know, and we need our land back and we need true freedom and sovereignty, right? So if that's your measure of liberation, a lot of people ain't willing to go down that road. You know, because a lot of people have accepted defeat and they accept our condition as divinely ordained. You know, they believe that, you know, the creator created white people to rule this world and he created us to, or, and they say he, like I'm using the Judeo-Christian term, he created us to serve them. So who are we to defy what the creator has divined? Or made, or what the creator has ordained, why should we fight it? Why should we not just be thankful for the comfort we're able to have within the system? And I think that that's how a lot of our people look at the situation. So for me, I'm not easily moved, and I do require more of us, and I will speak openly, you know, if I see something that is not truly getting us towards liberation. Like, I don't think we have time for half measures. We don't have time for theatrics. And we don't have time for feel good rhetoric. I think that we have to be serious. And I think that, you know, being serious requires doing that deep analysis and being real to say, hey, this is not something that's going to work for us. We need to do something different.
You know, that synopsis that you just gave about how our people view themselves here with Europeans is sad but true. I'd like to say it's a small percentage of our people that believe that. I'm talking about that wholeheartedly believe that, but I think it might be a little larger than that. But that mindset is changing. I do have faith that it's changing, and I can see the change. But let's get back to some of the lectures, Brother Omowale. Before I leave that first one, you made a comment about when you gave the synopsis of that first lecture, which is entitled, and with, for the listeners that tuned in late, we're talking to Brother Omowale Africa, the Vice Sanudi of Afrocentricity International in Philadelphia here on Time for an Awakening. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. That first lecture, Ethnic Cleansing of Black America and the Black Immigrant Paradox. And you mentioned when you ended that synopsis that the moves made here by Europeans is also duplicated on the continent and in the diaspora.
Yeah.
Tell me why, because some of our people see themselves as different, but what you describe, you describe the Europeans seeing us all the same.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
I mean, I think the Europeans, I think they deal with it as a unitary problem, meaning when they look at us, they could care less about our different colonial identities. They look at it as the African problem. And for them, it's very simple. The European has a need to control the resources of African people, right? And what creates a problem is you have these people who won't just simply accept, you know, won't just simply accept their dominance. And what I mean by that, like, it's okay. Let me go into a little bit of detail here. Let me explain how colonization, you know, works, right? So we as people, right, are given everything that we require to survive when we are born. Right? Everything that we need comes from the land, right? The land is our means of survival. The land clothes you, it feeds you, it houses you, it sustains you, and it nourishes you, right? When we're put on this earth, we all have an apportionment, right? A divine apportionment of this earth assigned to us as people. Now, when somebody takes your land from you, essentially what they've removed from you is your ability to survive. And if you no longer have control of your land, then you have to find a secondary means of survival. Now, that secondary means of survival is what's known as employment. You have to go and sell your labor to the people who control the land so that you can receive some type of currency that you can use to access the wealth or the materials of the land, right? This is something that you previously controlled, but you no longer control. Now, when you're in a situation where somebody controls your land, but your labor is also no longer needed, then their problem is, how do we dispose of this unwanted material, meaning the people? Like, yeah, we want the land, we want the resources and the materials that come with the land, but we don't want the people who currently occupy the land, right? So there was a point in time where they required our labor and they enslaved us, right? So they dealt with us one way. But as their economy transformed and they no longer require that form of labor, then the question becomes, what do we do with all these excess bodies, right? Because that's how they are looking at us.
Mm-hmm.
So collectively, they're all, meaning collectively, and when I say them, I mean Europeans, whether it be the French, the British, the Americans, the Spanish, they're all trying to deal with the same problem. How do we get rid of these unwanted black people who occupy our colonies, right? Because they look at our land as their possession, and they deem it as something that is divinely ordained, right? So when you're dealing with that, they trade in, you know, best practices. They say, hey, we found this particular thing to be successful when dealing with our blacks here in Jamaica. Maybe you might want to see if it works on your blacks in America, right? Or they'll say, hey, we found this thing here to be successful on our blacks here in America. Let's see if it works on our blacks in South Africa, right? So it's like they trade in the information, right? Carter G. Woodson, in his book, The Miseducation of the Negro, he said at the beginning of the 20th century, you had Europeans from all over the world come into America to learn from white Americans how they solve the race problem here. because they said what was done for black people here in America, nothing needs to be done differently than for the blacks in their own colonies. So they came here to study the relationships and the dynamics here so they can go implement them elsewhere. So that's why I'm saying when we're dealing with this conflict and this struggle that we're engaged in, if we're not paying attention to how our enemy creates these ethnic conflicts between population, right? Between different populations, right? This is where I'm talking about, like the black immigrant paradox. Because the black immigrant paradox, yeah, it looks one way in America, but there have been similar situations created all over the continent. But if you're not seeing how it works, then you as a black person, not thinking correctly, is going to start looking at the black immigrant as your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But at the same time, I think it's very important to not seek to dismiss some of the claims I don't want to get into too much detail, because when I tell you I'm leading with this lecture, because this is probably going to be the most heaviest and best one. It's a lot.
You gave us enough. You gave us enough. Let's go to the next one here, and this is interesting. Garveyism and the renewed cry for African sovereignty.
Yeah, this is I'm a Garveyite.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm a young and I'm a maturing Garveyite, but nevertheless, I am a Garveyite. So this one is important because Garvey was about African sovereignty. He was not of the mind that we accept our domination, but please allow us a hand in the governing affairs of the colony. If you follow where I'm going with this,
okay.
Right? There's a line of thinking where you have black people who accept the fact that they are dominated and conquered, but they say, hey, it's not quite fair that I have to exist here under a white government. Allow me, you know, to govern myself. So, like, I'm okay with the colony, with the colonial state, but let me be the manager of it, right? That's the kind of like those who want to be incorporated into the colony, who want to become the managers of the colony, who want to become the managers of someone else's property, right? Like, that's not an African sovereignty mind state. That's an integrationist mind state. I want to be integrated into somebody else's system.
Mm-hmm.
Garvey stressed the importance of sovereignty, developing a nation on the African continent that would be strong enough to protect the interests of African people everywhere. Right. That does not exist. It has never existed. It's aspirational. What exists is we have a situation where people still embrace these different colonial identities, and they believe that, oh, if only we had the right type of manager of the colony, then things would be better for the people who are imprisoned within the colony. Right. They look at it like, oh, Africa suffers from bad leadership, meaning the leaders are corrupt and they aren't doing the right thing. If we can get the right type of leaders, then the colony will just be perfect. And that's never going to happen, because that's not the purpose of a colony. The purpose of a colony is to extract resources. So it doesn't matter if you have all the – it's like when Barack Obama got into office, right? When Barack Obama was managing the colony, like, we saw a person, he can't do nothing for black people. Like, the colony, the government of the colony is what it is. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he had a mandate, and he carried it out. So no matter how good you think a person is, until the colony is destroyed and something else is put in its place, right, something of your own creation, right, then you're going to continue to be dominated. And, like, right now, when I say the renewed cry for African sovereignty, is because we're seeing right now among the younger generation of African people, there is this cry. I don't think the cry has reached, a state of political maturity, but I think the expression, what's behind it, is a desire for sovereignty, even though it's not being properly articulated at the moment. So it's my desire with this particular lecture to properly articulate what I feel is being expressed by young people, and to introduce to some and present to others, you know, Garvey and what that looks like in a 21st century context.
Okay. All right. Let's go to lecture number three, which will be hosted on March the 1st, 2020 at 1 in the afternoon. The Pan-African Costume Ball and the Climate of Confusion. That sounds like an interesting title.
Yeah. It's funny. I got Brother Obi Egbona.
Okay.
I read one of his essays once, and he said something about a costume ball. So that inspired the title. Once I read that, that inspired the title of the Pan-African Costume Ball and the Climate of Confusion. And this really just deals with, you know, I want to say over the past year, like with like the rise of like, you know, these local movements in America, like ADOS, it exposed the fact that a lot of people who said that they were Pan-Africanists, you know, were not, or they just, you know, they don't know what Pan-Africanism means, right? So when I say the Pan-African Costume Ball, I'm really dealing with, you know, all the people who are using, you know, Pan-Africanist language or talking points to further their own individual agendas. But when the rubber meets the road, their whole situation is easily exposed. And when I'm dealing with the climate of confusion, you know, I'm dealing with the fact that, you know, there's a war for our minds. You know what I mean? And I think the way that they keep us in this situation of being dominated is by maintaining us in the state of confusion.
Yes.
You know what I mean? He keeping us misoriented or disoriented or dislocated from even using the right proper terminology. But that's really what I'm dealing with there. I mean, I can't give away. I don't want to give away too much.
I understand. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's why I just wanted a little synopsis.
At a high level, that's what I'm dealing with that one.
Now, that fourth lecture, Richard covered that when he brought that up, and you talked a little bit about it. Let's go to number five, and that's part of the Nigerianism on trial, part two, the corrupted seed.
Number five, I'm dealing with the corrupted seeds of Mama Africa. Mm-hmm. This just basically points to the fact that when you are engaged in a struggle for nationhood or peoplehood, right, there's always two wars that you have to fight. You have to fight your enemy, but then you have to fight those amongst your society who've been conscripted by your enemy.
Wow.
And you'll never be successful at defeating your enemy until you successfully wage war against those within your group who are working, you know, by proxy on behalf of the enemy. You know what I mean?
No, you
got it. What was that?
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Yeah, so it's like you have to fight two wars at the same time, but you can't fool yourself into thinking that you can defeat your enemy and allow his proxies to exist within your ranks. You know what I mean? You gotta clean ranks, and that's what I'm dealing with here when I'm dealing with the corrupted seeds of Mama Africa. I'm dealing with that on so many different levels. You know, I'm dealing with it from a level of, you know, I don't like using the term class analysis, but I'm dealing with it from a level of the folks who have bought into society as existed, and they have vested interests in maintaining the status quo. So you got to deal with them because they have no interest in, you know, in anything revolutionary. And if what you require is revolutionary change in order for your liberation, then you're going to have them for an enemy to contend with. So you got to deal with them. It's different levels. You know what I mean? You got to deal with your Mubutus of the world. Like it's different levels. Like there's a whole class of leadership that only exists so that it can serve white supremacy. Like, and if you don't deal with that class of traitors and collaborators, then your chances of success are nil.
Let's go away from your lecture a minute, because myself, Brother Richard and I always talk about this. In any subject we're dealing with, it always comes back around to this, that we have to develop some type of way that we can deal with what you're saying, collaborate, however you want to term them, because these type of people and that mindset among us is dangerous. It was used heavily during the period of COINTELPRO, which still exists now, but during the periods of the quote-unquote civil rights movement, the Black Power era, this was used to destroy movements, to destroy people, to kill people, and some of these people still walk around among us if they haven't passed away by now. But that mindset is still fertile ground for Europeans to use some of our people. We have to develop a way to deal with these people, or none of our sovereignty, freedom, movements for our people will be successful if we don't come up with a way to deal with this mindset among our people. We have to.
Yeah, and we got to get serious about it. I think Mama Frances Cress Wilson has this quote that comes out of the ISIS papers, and I'm just paraphrasing here, but she talks about all of the different behaviors that we engage in to keep us from dealing with the reality that we're truly faced with, and that reality being war, right? We engage in all these childish antics to distract ourselves from the fact that we are at war, because the reality is, we don't want to acknowledge or accept that we're at war, because if we acknowledge and accept it, then that means that we got to do something. And what's required, you know, a lot of us don't have the stomach for it. A lot of us have been declawed by these different ideologies. And what it's going to take to truly be free, you know, a lot of us ain't really even ready to even entertain, you know, those ideas. And I think that we got to get to that point, you know, and I think it would be foolish of us to allow external factors to push us there. And we're now doing it from a point of reacting, because whenever you're doing something from a reactionary standpoint, that means somebody else is controlling you, because they can manipulate and pull the levers to get you to react however they need you to react. But if you're doing it proactively, you understand the nature that you're engaged in struggle, then you can really start to examine your enemy. You can play chess a little bit better, right? You can say, okay, I played 1,000 rounds of chess with my enemy. Out of these 1,000 rounds, he's beat me 1,000 games. But, like, I've learned all of his maneuvers. How about I spend some time studying our past games so I can have a better understanding of how he moves, and I can use that knowledge so that I can move better? And I think for us, that's what we're not doing. Like, we don't want to acknowledge that we're in a conflict, so therefore we're not examining the history of this conflict, and we're not examining how when we move one way, you know, our oppressor moved another, right? We're supposed to be examining all those things and learning from it, but we just don't want to deal with it. We're very, very childlike in our thinking. We have this notion that somebody else is going to deal with it. You know, I always tease, and I say it playfully, but there's a bit of truth in there. You know, when it comes to things like survival, you know, Black people are like, you know, I'm not worried about that. The white man gonna take care of my survival. You know, and that's the thinking. You know, so when it comes to preparing, like, you know, we not worried about it. We are very childlike. Our parents are going to deal with it for us because we not doing it. So that's what we up against.
You know, before I deal with this last one and then get you to put a bow on everything, let me go back to what you state here is the corrupted seed of Mama Africa. And I'll use something that the media used to draw a new image of one of our icons. The media used this movie of Harriet to draw a sanitized version of Harriet Tubman. That if we don't go back and clean up the mess, so to speak, and give our young people a view of the reality of the situation that she was dealing with, the reality of the environment, and what she was probably doing, then we do our children a disservice. And I'm saying that to say this. It's stated through historical accounts and I guess you say legend to a certain example that Harriet stayed armed. When she first escaped and came all the way here, basically running and walking, well, she probably didn't do much walking, running through swamps and forests till she escaped. Her life was in jeopardy. Lots of money was given towards her capture. But she went back and forth. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, you cleared me up, Brother O'Malley, because you, even though you're a millennial, you're a very deep thinker and a historian. She went back to the same plantation because her husband was there to try to talk him into leaving with her. And he didn't. But she went to other plantations when she was going back and forth down south. Our people had to know that she was coming. She didn't just pop up, but here I am. They had to know prior to that she was coming so they could prepare whoever wanted to leave with her. So in that case, and I want you to weigh in with this, Richard. In that case, other people knew that she was coming. And I'm talking about Tom, however you want to name them, Uncle Tom's, Coons, whatever, on the plantations knew that she was coming. So our people had to find ways to deal with them because Harriet's life would have been in jeopardy. And I knew with that gun she had to eliminate some problems that was impediments to her freedom. I know that she did. I know that she did. We don't talk about it. And I don't expect these sanitized versions of what they consider Harriet Tubman to ever talk about it. But I know the type of woman that is described in our historical accounts that she dealt with confrontations to her freedom the way she intended to. Just talk about that from your perspective of history. And Richard, weigh in on this. Do you think that she ever encountered a time when she had to deal with this thing in a real way, if you know what I'm talking about?
I mean, I don't see how she can engage in that type of activity and not.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
I agree.
I think it comes with the territory. Like you wanna, and that's what I mean by certain stuff we're gonna have to do. A lot of us ain't even prepared to entertain because we don't have like that war, that conflict type consciousness. But like, if you have people, I don't care if you black, if you an impediment to my freedom. You know what I mean? You ain't doing me no favors by being here, so I'm not going to do you no favors by keeping you here. So I think that it goes without saying she would have had to deal with things accordingly.
Yeah, exactly.
And I absolutely believe that she did.
I know it. And see, that's the thing. You know, we can't, you know, all of a sudden these white folks have a fascination with Harriet Tubman. They wait till 2019 to make some movie about her. And it's all a sanitized storybook version with all types of a falsehood and lies mixed in. But we should have been telling our children about our icons and about Harriet Tubman and what she had to go through during that period.
Well, you gotta understand, Brother Elliot, that, you know, institutions are our means of cultural exchange where we hand over culture and memory from generation to generation. We don't have, the only institution or the most important institution that any nation has is the institution of the family. But even beyond the family, there are multiple institutions that exist throughout a society that helps that society's memory and culture to be handed from generation to generation. We exist in a reality where our institutions have been destroyed. You know, so a lot of the information exists, but it's in pockets.
Okay.
It's fragmented. You know what I mean? Like our institution, the family institution, we know that this country a long time ago figured out that if we're going to effectively destroy their movements, then we have to
destroy
that family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, for the past 40, 50 years, they've been working diligently to destroy that. So that institution is probably at its weakened state that it's ever been. But our other institutions, like we had organizations and community institutions that housed and stored our memories, but what's happening? Who maintains them? Who finances them? You know, who you know, att- attends them. And the fact that we don't have that in our community is the reason why we can't aren't able to effectively pass this information down to our children in our own way. And we have to rely on them to tell our story. And when they're telling our story, they're going to tell it to their liking.
It's one thing that both of you brought up that I thought was interesting in the context you raised, Elliot. Brother Omawali, about the learning the thousand in playing a thousand games of chess and reevaluating the moves of the opposition or European oppressor, and you're in dealing with Harriet, Elliot, you brought up about knowing that she was coming, that the places that she went to, that they knew that she was coming. It raises another weapon that, to me, has to be developed, strengthened, as it deals with the internal opposition. And that's the weapon of the intelligence network. Because for people to know that she was coming, that means that there was an information network going from where she was and when she was leaving to those, and even characterized, which I believe, identifying what people are really going to make the move.
Mm-hmm.
Like in any plantation, some were small, 10 people or more, and then others were larger.
Exactly.
So you got to weed out those individuals, even to who you talk to.
Yep.
So the you know, when we talk about weapons and dealing with this, especially in dealing with the internal opposition, that it's, for me, it seems that we're negating the understanding, because in this here whole thing of gamemanship or intelligence work, it is identifying the one who would be the collaborator, even if they don't know that they're identified, so that they, that the information of who is going to make moves, again playing chess, can be incorporate that piece in how you move in order to get to the outcome that you're looking for. So I think that's important to realize, even in that period, we had a solid intelligence network.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be as vital as a gun.
Yes.
Agreed.
Yes. You know, I let my mind go back sometimes, and just when I'm just alone thinking about the times of our ancestors. Listen, Richard and Brother Wally, when she came to those different plantations, they didn't have time to, okay, let's have a meeting. Who wants to leave with Harriet? I don't know. I don't want to. They didn't have. You already had people that was prepared, because everything had to be boom, boom, boom. It had to be on time and precise, or they would have captured her and hung her and dismembered her like they did to Nat Turner. So they had to be ready. So, you know, that's why, you know, I hate when they do some of these movies about our ancestors, because I know how white folks going to spin them. That type of, what she had to go through was more than any of us could imagine. It was just more than any of us could even fathom. She didn't have time when they go to the plantation. Who's going? Who wants to go? Come on, I'm ready. No, it wasn't like that at all. And for anybody that believes that, please do some more studying.
And also that, you know, in the talk that was for today, when you put it in that context, because it isn't that kind of, you know, collective, you know, decision-making process or whatever. It is some kind of structural order in what will take place, when it will take place, and who's going to be the benefactors of this transaction taking place. That is structural. In some kind of ordered kind of way.
That last lecture, Brother Omawali, is going to take place on April the 19th at 1 p.m. The significance of African spirituality and the war for the African mind. I think that's the ideal way to end this particular segment of your lecture series. Just give us a little brief synopsis.
Yeah, I always have to do a piece on African spirituality and its significance, you know, as a tool to aid in our liberation. And I think that you know, sometimes when you have something that's powerful, like Dr. You know, Nana Amos Wilson used to say, sometimes we do things by mistake and don't recognize the power of them, but our enemies do. And not that we engage in African spirituality by mistake, but our enemy clearly recognizes the threat and has gone through extents to properly ensure that it is not practiced en masse because of the threat that it presents to them maintaining their dominance over us as a collective. And what I'm doing with that is, A, the first thing I'm doing is just showing, you know, documented accounts of our enemy going into great detail, explaining the necessity for them to prevent us from practicing African spirituality. And in so many words, seeing it as a matter of national security. That's one. And two, I'm tying it to, like, some of the most notable resistance struggles that so many people know nothing about and the role African spirituality played in those struggles, right? So that's the second part. And then the war for the African mind part, I mean, that's deep, you know, because I'm really dealing with, you know, the attempts by our enemies to capture the minds of our young people through entertainment, this game is deep. There are people who have deeply vested interests into keeping things the way that they currently are and to maintaining the status quo. And those people who have those deeply vested interests into maintaining the status quo have developed all types of mechanisms to keep you operating and functioning in a manner that will keep them in their current position and keep you in your current position. But at the end of the day, even if you ever break free from that thinking, they are prepared to take things to the ultimate outcome. You know what I mean? Like to maintain what they have. And if you're not willing to meet them with equal force or dedication, you might as well give up. And I think that's – I'm not telling our people to give up. I'm stressing what's going to be required. And when I say equal force, that doesn't mean equal, you know, technical mastery. You know, we might not have the weapons that they have. We might not have the technology that they have. But that doesn't mean that you can't meet them with equal force if you properly understand force. So – that's what I'm dealing with in that last lecture.
Brother Wally, I think it's going to be interesting either way. I wish I was able to attend today, but I'm kind of always in touch somewhat with Brother Kalmbach, with Professor Kalmbach. So
I'm heavily influenced by Dr. Amos Wilson. Most of, I would say I'm heavily influenced by Dr. Marimba Ani. And, you know, so when it comes to power, when it comes to sovereignty, when it comes to our geopolitical sovereignty, our geopolitical situation as African people, my analysis and the way that I look at things is a lot different than the way a lot of other people view them. And I feel like if I can, you know, just kind of like by presenting critical analysis, help people to develop a critical analysis of their own, then you'll have more people kind of like just thinking and operating in the right fashion. And that's kind of like what this whole lecture series is about, the political awakening of African consciousness.
Yeah, Brother Wally, when the workshop starts during the late spring and summer, is it some that are directed towards our young people, towards the youth, or is it?
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead.
So we have a whole youth programming committee that their whole function within the chapter is just that, to help us develop programs and initiatives for our young people. right? So one of the programs that we're looking to we haven't formally announced it to the public yet because we need to do like a closed fundraising for it, you know, to see if we can get some sponsors in the community to help cover calls.
Okay.
But it's a program that we have. It's called Breakfast with the Ancestors. And what we're trying to do is over the summer, you know, on Sundays, we want to bring in a group of young people ages for this particular program will be like 12 to 16. And AI has produced two volumes of text referred to as African Foundations. They're workbooks for children, and any children ages 8 to 14 can use these workbooks. But within the workbook, it has significant African personalities who were victorious, you know, heroic, you know, in their thinking and in their action. And these are all African personalities that many of our young people will never be introduced to within the colonial education framework. So you're not going to get introduced to these people and their significance in public schools. But what we would do within this program is called Breakfast with the Ancestors. We would work with the kids on a Sunday where we would basically sit with them in a group setting, cover one of the individuals in the book, you know, provide them a meal. We would just have open discussion about why this person is significant and how does, you know, what they did then apply to where we are today. And based upon that, what are some things that you as a young person can do today to help, you know, continue carrying out the mission that they started, you know, or that they added to. So that's really like the focus of that particular program. It's one youth program, but we're working on lots of them.
Okay. All right. Well, before we leave tonight, and I'm going to let you go back because I know your family there is waiting on you. Give the listening audience ways that they can join the chapter or join, because we have people listening from all over, where they can join other chapters in their area and get involved.
Yeah. We have definitely, they can come out and get involved. Our chapter, AI Philly, you know, we meet every first and third Sunday at the Malefic at the Asante Institute at 1 p.m. But, you know, like I said, we have the African World Order podcast coming. We do the annual trip, the Malcolm X Day pilgrimage to start off our AI week, right? So AI week for AI Philadelphia is every year from Malcolm X Day to African Liberation Day. So May 19th to May 25th, we try to do a week of activities as a chapter. And we always start that week off with the trip, the pilgrimage up to the Malcolm X Day pilgrimage. We have the convention to Brazil this year. So AI as an organization, right? So that includes all of its affiliate chapters like AI Philly. Our annual convention, the way that they're structured is typically we have two on the continent and then we have two on the diaspora, like back to back like that. So in 2017, it was in Haiti. So that was in the diaspora. 2018, it was in Benin, so that was on the continent. 2019, it was in the Ivory Coast, that was on the continent. 2020, it comes back into the diaspora, so it's going to be in Brazil this year. So that's going to be from May the 28th to June the 9th, we'll be in Brazil. And then on August the 13th, you can definitely save the date for this, is this year marks the 100-year centennial celebration of the RBG flag. So Marcus Garvey and the UNIA officially recognized the colors red, black, and green as the colors of our race on August the 13th, 1920, during the UNIA convention. This was also the year when they developed the Declaration of Rights for Negro Peoples of the World. So this is a significant period. So we're going to be commemorating that on the 13th of August. We're looking to have a major event in the city. Location and details to follow, but definitely save the date. And if you want to get involved with us, you can always reach out.
Brother Wally, listen, I want to thank you for your contribution, for the things that you're doing. This think tank, by any stretch of words that you can use, is very necessary here in Philadelphia. And it's going to change minds, and it's going to spark people to work. That's all I'm going to say about it. I know that your work is going to spark other people, whether it's millennials, whether it's younger. I don't know the generation that's under millennials. They got all these terms. but it's going to spark people to get involved. And again, I want to thank you for what you're doing.
I appreciate it, brother Elliot.
Good.
The same here, and I would say to all who are listening, because you know, and you did bring up about the young people that by going through the, it's two sides by attending AI and going through the process, even just going through the series, and that's your personal development as far as challenging what you believe. But also I'm looking at that this is truly good for those who are self-identified organizers, because it just assists in being able to just engaging in the concepts, the thoughts, the expression that Brother Omar Wiley is looking at what you're organizing. Because I just a firm believer that an organizer is a particular skill that requires having the critical thinking skill as one of its core operating tools. If you don't have that, as far as an African person, and dealing with that, it is about power and it is about war, then you're really something else, and then a little, arrogant, delusional. Mm. So I ask all those who are self-proclaimed organized to at least consider going through, and if not challenging yourself, at least even challenging Brother Omar Wiley, because I like to see, I sit there waiting for somebody to say something.
Hey, Brother Omar Wiley.
They do, Brother Rich. They, just, yeah. they don't say it when you're there. They do. I get challenged all the time.
Okay. Brother, thank you for your work, and we'll be talking to you soon.
All right, hold tight.
All right, peace. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll go the rest of the way in open forum. You can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves. As other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves,
then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
And leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. You can't feel it? When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them? Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk? Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine. Your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again.
We're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party, still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump.
So you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect.
When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible, for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And I want to thank our guest that was with us, spent a little time with us, the Vice Senuti of Afrocentricity International, Brother Omar Wiley Africa, talking about some of the programs that they have over there at the Institute, Black Think Tank, as I like to term it, Brother Richard, and some of his calendar of events happening this late winter and early spring, some of the things they're going to be doing over there. They kind of, well, it kicks off on the 2nd of February, but I think it kind of kicked off today with the lecture that you went to.
Yeah, it's they're definitely, you know, doing something. I really appreciate, you know, the work that they're doing, you know, and Brother Omar Wiley and the contributions that they're making, and just keeping us, you were mentioning earlier today, you know, how we have to stay energized. And it's knowing that there's people out there, there's work out there like this that keeps us energized. So I'm very glad for them and doing that, you know, putting together this series. I will be helpful, you know, in dealing with the different subject matters. I still can't figure out how I messed up Nigeria while I lead that one.
Yeah, I did see that. I was wondering where you was going when you read that. I will go in the open forum the rest of the way. I had a couple of articles I wanted to throw out there. Richard, I know you've seen where, well, I know that you know, I'm talking about you've seen where Dilbert Africa was released. Not Dilbert, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It wasn't Dilbert.
Oh, man, his name just skipped
out. Oh, man, boy. Boy, I don't want to pull up no articles because his name should be in my head. But one of our political prisoners was released from prison. Who was it? I think it was Wednesday. Wednesday, Richard, when he was, I think it would happen over the weekend or something. I think they just put the word out Wednesday that
yeah, it was Dilbert.
It was Dilbert. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That was released from prison. Out of the Move 9, I think it's only two left that are still alive, that are still in prison. If I'm not mistaken, one of our listeners here locally can correct me on that. But, you know, Richard, it's really frustrating when you see some of the leadership that's been in this city for a number of years. And you see now that one generation of the leaders now that has either went out of office, a few of them just are not doing it anymore, retired or whatever, and it's kind of a new generation of black elected officials that have went in, that have been sworn in, and you see that over the years that none of them have said anything about these political prisoners that have been sitting up in jail just riding there. Dilbert just got out after 42 years of sitting in that prison cell for something that none of those men or women did. That officer that got killed on the scene there. And let me just, because just in case if some of our listeners might not be familiar, let me read from this article that Professor Lynn Washington, who had been a guest on our program a while ago, had wrote in reference to Move, and it's a published report. It says all of the nine Move members, five men and four women, received the identical 30 to 100 year sentence, despite the inability of authorities to concisely state which Move member, if any, fired the fatal bullet that killed Officer James Rant, or even that if the killer bullet came from any of the guns that authorities claim Move members used during the firefight. During the lengthy non-jury Move 9 trial, police testified that only the five Move 9 males had rifles on August 8, 1978. Philadelphia Police Department officials initially denied that any police had the same type of rifle as the Move members. Police later changed that account, stating a few officers did have the same type of rifle as the Move men. But police then claimed those officers did not fire those rifles during the shootout. Evidence indicates police-friendly fire killed Officer James Ramp. But that didn't stop Move members from being in jail over 40 years. Eddie and Janine Africa just got out, I think it was early this year, or during the summer, Richard. So, you know, and it's political prisoners of our people that had been involved in struggles from the 60s to 70s on through these past decades that's sitting up languishing in prison. And none of the people who have some type of podium or political influence, if any of them do have that, or a bully pulpit to even talk about these issues or mentioning any of our political prisoners. And that's a sin and a shame. But,
and I would say they were scared to.
Yeah. Well, I fully agree with that, but you know, don't take those type of jobs where you're supposed to represent the interests of our people and don't speak to the issues that, that they're interested in or that that affects them. These men's families have been torn apart. I think it mentioned in one article that I read that his daughter was putting together some kind of GoFundMe page to help him get reacclimated into society and get him a place to stay. After this system destroyed these men and women's lives, they just put them out there after 40 years sitting up there in Graterford Prison or wherever they was held at and just say, okay, you see ya. Come on, this system here needs to be torn down, period. It don't work for our people. It don't work. Either we just have to leave it to these folks that created it and let them wallow in their own mire, or we got to do something. I'm looking at this one article, and it just goes towards the system. The system. I ain't talking about white people supreme to anybody, but the system of white supremacy that have been set up. Let me read this thing, Richard. And it was a published report I put on Time for Awakening Facebook page. It was earlier this week. It says minorities pay more to bank than whites, according to report. A new survey from Bankrate shows that African Americans pay more in banking fees than any other segments of the population. Banking fees are identified as normal fees paid by the customer for services, maintenance, upkeep of their bank account. Examples could include a fee to print checks, to open or have an account at a bank, or for wire transfers. A number of white adults who said they pay no fees are much higher than that of African Americans. More than 75% of whites said they didn't pay any banking fees in a typical month, compared to roughly 60% of blacks. Most checking accounts holders, 73%, says they don't pay monthly fees for their accounts. But the rest say that they spend anywhere between $1 and more than $50, a cost that includes ATM, overdraft fees, routine service charges. Of those checking account holders who pay monthly fees, the average person spends $28.61. These numbers dramatically vary based on race. More than three quarters, 78% of white respondents report that they pay no fees in a typical month, compared to 60% of blacks with checking accounts reported the highest amount in checking account cost on average is $15.85. That compared with blacks saying that their cost on average is $12.30, while whites report the least on average is $5.29. And then it has a little graph here on what on average the whites that have responded said that they pay and what blacks pay, which is almost double the checking account. And I mean, you pay more for a checking account and a bank account than whites do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm telling you, this system, it's rotten to the core for black people, period. And the more you educate yourself on what we're dealing with, the more than any sensible person would say that they don't want their children and their children's children growing up under the same struggle and fight that our parents had to deal with dealing with these Europeans. It don't work. And you wonder why you don't have anything. And a lot of our population is working poor or poor. Just coming down to the average check, they said the average white person they interviewed said they don't even pay any monthly fees. Go ahead, Richard.
It's just, you know, as you're saying, when you realize that the system was built off of black people itself, I mean, then you like you said, it's no way you should think that it should be what is being described should be anything different than what is being described. That the banks made money off of black people when black people were considered more upfront a commodity. I question now, at what point did we not become in this system become property, not a commodity? When did we not become that? Now, we can be free and still be a commodity, but even different than even whites. And because the structure of American economic infrastructure was based off of us being, I mean, when you look at it from that vantage point, as you say, the system is like, it needs us to be for other parts to make wealth off of. And what is the best wealth creator than a bank?
Exactly. Yeah, well, yeah. That's what, some of these discussions, it hasn't even dawned on our people. Some of the topics that is raised, and I'm just using Brother Umawale as an example because he was just on. Some of the topics that they'll be discussing next month, man, these conversations need to be had in places of worship, social orders, Greek letter organizations. They need to have these type of topics instead of where's the next party going to be at and who going to provide the liquor and who going to deal with the entertainment. And I'm not trying to minimize, or cast aspersions, but you know what I'm saying? Some of these important topics that can be discussed in the household after they're thrashed out among sensible adults, these topics need to be discussed in head because the strategies that need to be developed. Unless we're just going to go along and just react to things that happen in society and then get out there with a march or something like that or boycott that some of our people participate in and the majority of them won't. We got to do better than this. Let's go to the phones. Get 602.
Yes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Good evening. Brother Marcos here.
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing now?
All right, good brothers. You know that the church and these Greek organizations ain't going to do that, brother. You know that because they are a part of what the young brother was just talking about. You see, in order for the system to operate, right, they have to recruit from the same group of people that they are oppressing. And when you talk about, they talk about, you see how they use psychology on black people, minority. They say minority. We are not the minority on the planet. We may be the minority in America, but white folks are the minority on the planet. They are only 1/10 of the world's population. And in order for them to maintain power, they have to recruit from the group, the same group of people that they are oppressing. So those people you mentioned, these preachers, Greek letter organizations, and all these fraternities and sororities, the black boule, they are a part of the system too. And they benefit from the foolishness that's going on. But when I hear young brothers like Brother Umawale Africa come on, it gives me hope. If we had 10,000 like him, we'd be halfway there. You know what I'm saying? But it gives me hope. And when I say movements taking place like in Sudan, where they're saying, the people in Sudan say, you know what? We want a secular government. We don't want no more Islam or no more running the situation. We want a secular government. When the young people saying that, it gives me hope. So we're going to find a way to deal with these collaborators. We're going to find a way to deal with them where they have to keep looking over their shoulder. Okay? When they walk. The kids, they have to look over their shoulder. It's going to get to that stage. I'm sure of that. You see? So I am hopeful because African liberation is a must. Okay, they can't stop it. It's just when. It may happen tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? We just got to take the revolution to the people, to the masses of the people. Those governments and things, we don't worry about them. It's the message to the people, because once the people move, we're going to sweep them away with a big broom, brother. But anyway, I appreciate your program. I appreciate this platform. It's a powerful platform. And your brothers, please keep on keeping on. Thank you so much.
All right now. Have a good evening.
All right.
Let's go to 215.
Good afternoon. Good evening, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. How y'all brothers doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Our praise be to Allah. I want to say first, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, I enjoyed your interview, Brother Omar Wally. What a beautiful young brother, like Brother Marcus said. With brothers like that, it give me hope and stuff, man. And like you said, Elliot, his lectures, the 3 or 4 lectures he's going to give, is definitely going to help change minds and stuff. And that's the key. Like you said, it starts with the mind first. That'll definitely... help our people out and stuff, like you say, Brother Elliot. Change minds, man. But, you know, Brother, I don't know where to begin on Dub in Africa. I'm glad you mentioned our brother being freed over the weekend or whatever. It's something about that black man being black woman so strong. Them devils that already cut up in that prison to destroy that brother. He was on Michael Kors' show on Terrestrial Raiders that he said how they kept him in a hole for several months, like a year, 2 years, whatever it was, and they was trying to break his will because he refused to get his dreadlocks cut. And he still, when his brother was talking, even Brother Mike said, he said, Brother, I'm just surprised you're not crazy or broken. He said, they couldn't break me. And if you heard him speak today, Brother Ellen, Brother Richard, you'll think this brother's been out in public free for the last 40-something years as opposed to being in the belly of the beast. Spirit, still talk intelligent, still intellectual, still strong, still intellectual, articulate, everything. I mean, you can't break the will of a strong black man and woman. You know what I'm saying? No matter how they try.
Now, if you research this, Joe, it's supposed to be against the law to keep a man in solitary confinement for that length of time.
That's right.
I think it's like 30 days, 60 days is supposed to be the humane barrier, however they term it. And I want the listeners to check that. That's supposed to be against the law. But if you notice, sure, several of these black political prisoners been in solitary confinement for a number of years. That would drive a man crazy.
Sure. And that's why I say that's something about the black man and woman being so strong, because Lord knows they do all they can to destroy our people and stuff, man. But our people still come out of a strong majority of the time because we got a strong will. And so, like, you look at Harriet Tubman, like you was talking to Brother Omar Wally about that. I mean, that sister wasn't no joke. Like, the fact that she was able to come back that many times in the South to free up people and stuff like that, man. I mean, you can't break a strong black woman. And the white man knows that's why he does every kind of rotten down, low down, dirty trick he can do to our people. Because you know what kind of people he's dealing with, man. He's not dealing with no punk people. And so that's why, like you correctly said, Elliot, that's why it's so sad that you've got these black elected officials. What they are they there for? All these Negroes are the last 40-something years, none of them used their podium to speak up for Brother Dub in Africa and the rest of the Move 9. I mean, it's disgraceful, man. I mean, these Negroes, they not worth a dollar. And see, Elliot, that brings me to my next point. I was watching a little bit of the game early, the second game, the NFL playoff. And once again, I'm not trying to scare a person on our people. They had Boys and Men singing the national anthem, you know, of course. And they had them, you know, doing acapella style. And, of course, you saw Jerry Rice and some of the black players with their hand over their heart. And I know as I'm watching this and scanning the sidelines, I saw several of the white players not with their hand over their heart, but I saw Jerry Rice and some of the other brothers. I'm thinking, wow, people just continually do that to themselves. I don't know. It just boggles my mind. I said, here you got the white boys not even having a hand over their heart, and yet the Negroes with their hands over their heart like they're so patriotic and stuff. I mean, I don't know. It's just amazing, man. But anyway, Elliot, that brings me to my next point. I was listening to Maxine Waters, and she was on earlier tonight on one of the cable channels. And of course, she's talking about the idiot in the White House, among other things. But the white girl asked her about why, you know, is she upset because it's no black candidates except for Deval Patrick, and he really ain't making no noise on the presidential platform. And I said, the reason why I'm saying this to myself, Ellen Richard, I'm saying the reason why ain't none of them become relevant, Kamala Harris or Corey, because they don't speak the black issues. I said, you can't just sit there and talk about, well, like Corey, that little lip service, well, I'm down with reparations. If you ain't got no follow-up and you're not, you know, pushing it and stuff like that, you know, you're not going to just fool black people. And it show you, and the reason I bring this up, Brother Ellen, Brother Richard, I don't know if y'all heard what Michael Bloomberg did today. And you know, yeah, we know what he's about, but get a Caucasian credit. He's smart. He spoke down in Tulsa, Oklahoma today to black folks in Tulsa with black, from the Black Wall Street Greenwood Project, dealing with Black Wall Street and the survivors of black. He spoke to them at a church or rec center or something like that. He spoke as a whole group, spoke before a whole group of black people. Michael Bloomberg said out of his own mouth today. Of course, you know, with any your opinion, you got to make sure you press them because their word ain't worth the paper is, or the microphone it comes out of or the paper that's printed on. But was smart enough to tell black folks, he told them, right, there's a whole bunch of black people. He said, look, if I'm elected president, I'm going to make sure that I start a black wealth project to make sure that black people can close the racial gap between blacks and whites in this country. And he went on to say, I fully support H.R. 40 for the study of reparations. Now, why couldn't Kamala Harris or Corey said that and say that in a way like he did? And see, my point, Brother Ellen Richard, is that, see, when I heard black people say, well, you know, if a black person, how many anybody talk about blacks, they can't. That's BS, because black people are not stupid. When you speak to black people issues, they respond in kind. But see, them niggas, they so scared to speak, be black. Bloomberg had enough sense. No, like I said, no, whether he's sincere or not, that remain to be, because I don't trust him unless you put pressure on like any other of them. But the point is, the man had enough sense to address that, because he know what black people was feeling. Why couldn't Cory Booker or Kamala Harris or Deval Patrick do that? You know what I mean? See, this is why, that's why they even get the support of black. That's why Kamala Harris and Cory Booker no longer in the race now, because they did not address black issues, man. You know what I mean? You can't keep on playing that game with black people. I'm going to be the president for everybody. Well, damn it, everybody don't always vote for you. You got to first get your core support of black folks and stuff. If it weren't for black folks, Obama would have never set foot in that White House. But you got silly Negroes always on the radio, well, he can't be the president just for black people. I mean, I get so tired of that foolishness and stuff, man. You know, this is why people could be continually be behind an eight ball, and this is why Cory Booker and Kamala Harris are no longer candidates right now. Because they did not speak directly to black issues and stuff. Why couldn't Cory Booker or Kamala get up there and say, well, why is it that Mommy Abu Jamar still in prison? Why is that? That this one is. Why is the move? The remaining move two or three still in prison? You know what I mean? They could. They know about move. They could have spoke on it. But see, again, they don't speak on black issues, man. And they wonder why they don't get the support. Until you start talking directly to black issues, you're gonna be. You're going to be a non-factor. And that's the way it's going to be, because black people get more and more aware and conscious. They're not going for this BS no more, man. Most conscious black people, except for fruit, they tired of the BS and stuff, man. And Elliot and Richard, I'll say these last few things, and I go. You talked about Sister Harriet Tubman. And, you know, as you was talking to Brother Omar Wiley about her, you know, Elliot, again, we the only people that we even allow, and I heard Negroes on terrestrial radio saying, well, what's the big deal? As you know, they made the sanitized version of Harriet, Elliot, and Richard. They was talking about getting Julia Roberts, a white actress, to play Harriet Tubman. Now, again, I don't have nothing against Julia Roberts per se, you know, but my point is that we the only people, and I heard Negroes saying, well, what's the big deal? You would never get a Jewish person or any white Caucasian person to get a black person to portray any of their iconic figures. But yet we are so silly in our self-hatred and our stupidity that we is willing to go along with that. That you tell me, Elliot and Richard, that's an insult. They even consider a white actress to play Harriet Tubman, you know? But see, this is the kind of stuff that white people do to our people, man, because they have no respect for our people's legacy or history or whatever you want to call it. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I follow you.
I mean, Julia Roberts. I mean, I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Julia Roberts, it wasn't for, I guess, other black folks that's in their industry or whatever, raising saying, they probably would have got Julia Roberts. They probably would have painted her with blackface. I mean, because that's the only way she would have been able to play Harriet Tubman. They had to paint her with blackface, which would even be more insulting. You know what I mean? So I'm saying the stuff, it's just our people, we just go for the nonsense. And with Dr. King's birthday on the horizon, well, not his birthday, because he actually was born the 15th, but with his celebration that they do tomorrow, again, Brother Mo said it's so best on terrestrial radio. We know we got to stop, you know, we got to start holding these black elected officials accountable, because they're going to have our black children throughout Philadelphia, Elliot and Richard, and to the Time for the Wicked listener audience, throughout the United States, cleaning sidewalks, painting sidewalks, painting schools, playgrounds, and stuff. And all you're going to get these black children is a damn sandwich and a T-shirt or a soda. You know, pay our black children a salary. Get them a stipend. Get them a scholarship. Because damn it, the white folks that's putting on the Todd Bernsteins of the world, these people getting six-figure salaries. It's an insult to Dr. King's legacy, because here this man died going out of Memphis with Brother Marcus, is that he went down there with the sole purpose of helping black sanitation workers get a livable wage so they could take care of their family. A livable wage he went down and he died for. And you're going to sit there and have our black people working for free. You know what I mean? You saw a black man with signs saying, "I'm a man." I mean, it's insulting and stuff, man, for free. Dr. King, I know he's turned over his grave for that foolish that used this man's holiday and stuff for that nonsense. Why these white people getting rich and stuff, man, making big bucks while people getting a damn T-shirt and a damn sandwich. Man, come on, man. This stuff has got to stop, Ellen Richard, you know? And I know one thing, if I'm out there tomorrow, which I'm not going to be, but if I was out there tomorrow cleaning any place for this city, whatever, you can be darn sure they're going to pay Brother Joe. Brother Joe ain't cleaning nobody's sidewalk or sweeping or painting for free. I don't work for free. You know what I'm saying? They're going to pay me something, you know? I mean, it's just, you just get tired of the fool, and these Negroes, these black elected officials go over all these smiling and hitting and grinning, knowing these white folks is making big bucks off of Dr. King's name. Why these black kids getting a T-shirt and a damn sandwich? You got to be kidding me, man. You know.
Now, where did you say that Bloomberg was? He was speaking at a church.
He spoke
in Tulsa?
Down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He spoke down. You and Richard can pull it up. He spoke down in Tulsa, Oklahoma today at either a black church or a black rec center.
Well, you know, you know, he wasn't at a rec center. He's most likely at a church.
Maybe at the church and stuff. I know I saw a number of black people around him, and he was talking about the Greenwood Project. You know, talking probably to survive. Of the Tulsa, the Black Wall Street. So he was talking to them, and he stated clearly, as I'm watching them on cable, he stated clearly that he gonna push for black wealth, for black wealth, for blacks to catch up with the whites with the wealth gap and stuff, and say how he fully support H.R. 40 for the study of reparations. And I'm saying to myself, why can't them Negroes have got up there and said that strong?
Well, I'm just curious. When is he going to a large Catholic church or the Mormon church and speak, or when is he going to the large Jewish synagogues? When is he going, you know,
I agree.
What is these white politicians' fixation to going to the black church? And why do these black ministers open the door and let these people get up in the pulpit to speak?
They do it all.
That's a rhetorical question, but I'm just saying.
Well, you make a good point, because Andrew Yang, the Asian candidate, he was at a black church, I think maybe in Atlanta, maybe. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you may know any better. I could be wrong, but he's at a black church, either in Atlanta, one southern city. He had put on a church.
Now, he's an Asian, and he's going to run in a black church.
Exactly. And not only was he in the alley, he had the robe on, Ellen Richard. He was singing with the choir. He was rocking back and forth. You know how black people do when they're in the choir. He was rocking back and forth, singing church hymns. I said,
done took a playbook straight out of the Caucasian thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, everybody does that to our people, man. I mean, it's just, remember, Ellen, when Hillary ran back in 2016, she was at my mother's church. She went to the church down in North Philadelphia, Reverend Hall's Triumph. She was down there singing and stuff and saying praise the Lord and stuff. I mean, they use our churches, brother, man. They use our churches till they can't use them up and stuff. But again, Ellie, it's not like they forcing these people to have them there. They ain't putting a gun in nobody's head. They willingly letting them come there. So, you know, I mean, it's just a sad situation. In the 70s, though, we don't get nothing out of it. We have strong black leadership on a national level, since Bloomberg made those comments about he's supporting the Black Wealth Project to increase black wealth and generational wealth among black people, and he's talking about he supports HR, then them Negroes need to make them.
Well, where's his track record? Where's his track record of doing that? He was mayor when a lot of that gentrification started up there in New York.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Where's his track record? They like it. Listen, the mayor, this mayor now here in Philadelphia, went in a black mm-hmm. church and told black people that if he was mayor, he was going to stop and frisk.
That's right.
So they don't mind telling lies in pulpit. They don't care about telling no lies in no black pulpit.
Exactly. Exactly. But see, that's the problem. We don't have none of these black leaders that hold it, that, and that are elected to hold these people accountable. They make excuses for him, like the Sherelle Parkers of the world, the Curtis Jones. They make excuses for Kenny. When Kenny didn't deliver on that stuff, they make excuses for these guys, man. You know what I mean? So that's why I say, ain't no black elected official going to hold Michael Bloomberg accountable and say, well, Mr. Bloomberg, you made this promise. Now that you're president or whatever, you're getting ready to be president, we want you to follow up on that. They're not going to do that. As long as them Negroes getting their salary and they living good, they don't care. And their kids going to the best schools, they don't care. See, I mean, like I said, you need a whole, I've been saying to you and Richard for the years on this show, you, until we get new black leadership in there on a city, state, and federal level, we're going to still get these sorry bunch of Negroes that ain't worth crap. Like I said, you can count on one hand and don't have to use all the fingers on that one hand the number of black elected officials that's in office on a city, state, or federal level that's worth anything, man. They really care about our people and really want to see our people move forward. The rest of them Negroes, all they do is play games. They give our people lip service. I mean, they are, when I say a disgrace, they put the D in disgrace, man. They're a sad excuse for people, man. It's really sad. And last point, Ellen Richard, again, with the Dr. King celebration tomorrow, again, they took a poll, and I close with this, Brother Ellen, and I thank you, Richard, y'all been so much generous with your time. They took a poll, and again, this serves for Dr. King. They said on Michael Kors' show, he went into the thing, he said that in 1968, the year Dr. King was assassinated, he said they took a poll among white Americans, and he had among 80% of white folks, he had an unfavorable rating and stuff. So all these white folks now, they say they love Dr. King. Yeah, you love him because he's dead. You know, he's no threat to you. But he was unfavorable. He had even an unfavorable rating even among so-called white liberals and many black people, because he spoke out against the Vietnam War. He spoke out against the militarism of America, you know, being the number one purveyor of violence around the world, you know, bombing people, just like what Trump did the other week, killing that general in Iran. Yeah, I mean, he spoke about against that back in 66, 67, 68. And like the brother said, and I close with this, Ellen Richard, see where terrestrial radio here in Philadelphia do this service, because they know that they all they want to do is put stuff out, Dr. King image that's palatable to white people. They don't want to put the Dr. King out that when they play those speeches tomorrow all day on the terrestrial station. Are they going to be preaching this, I have a dream, that I want to see our people that stay at the table of brotherhood with white men and black men and Gentiles. I don't want to hear all that there stuff. Show the Dr. King that in 66 and 67, he met twice, not once, he met twice with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Prior to that, in 64, he briefly met with Malcolm up in Washington, D.C., This, and you're not going to tell me he'll meet with these men that have a profound effect on Dr. King, because after he met with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad twice, Dr. King's whole thing started changing as far as he looking at America and for what they stood for. And that's why he became more radicalized. And this is why he was so unpopular among white liberals as well as white conservatives as well as black preachers. And lastly, Ellen Richard, these like Brother Mo said, these black Negroes that was around Dr. King, these preachers and stuff, they sold Dr. King. They in a lot of ways, Ellen Richard, caught that. They was in a circle. Hoover, Dr. King's itinerary every day, and this is not Joe's opinion, Ellen Richard. This is documented fact. William Mackey documented that in this book, how they was going to meet with this racist sissy, J. Edgar Hoover, G. Edgar Hoover, as Dr. Collett would call him, with this, giving him itinerary on Dr. King's whereabouts, where he at, where he going to speak at, all this kind of stuff. See, I mean, these Negroes, boy, I'm telling you, me talking about this, and I'm not just talking about that photographer who we know sold Dr. King out and stuff, that photographer. I'm talking about some of them Negroes in this inner circle that was number collaborators. You understand what I'm saying, Ellen Richard? There was number collaborators, man. They may have cost that man his life. I'm just keeping it so. And I suggest that you and Rich, if you get a chance, get William Mackey's book about the conspiracy to kill Dr. King, where he put detailed information about how them Negroes and Dr. King's inner circle was selling Dr. King out the whole time. You know, and lastly, Elliot, don't forget that on April the 5th, which was the day after Dr. King was killed, Messy Jesse was standing up there on the Today Show with a white T-shirt on with blood told him Dr. King died in his arms. A damn lie. Dr. King didn't die. He died in Ralph Abernathy's arms. He the one that was cradling Dr. King, not Jesse Jackson. You know what I mean? I mean, we got to start looking at these people, man, for who they are and stuff, man. And I just close on that. Okay, Ali Richardson, again, thank y'all brothers for the time.
Talk to you soon.
Peace and blessings.
Let's go to 215 again. 215?
Yeah, that's me.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hey, bro, how you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, man. Yeah, no, Will Mackey didn't write a book. It was a DVD he did. And in the DVD, quote from a book, how Dr. King, how these Negroes met with J. Edgar Hoover every week and gave him their itinerary. And so J. Edgar Hoover knew where Dr. King was going to be. And that's how he was able to send out van scouts to bug his hotel rooms and what have you. And I was saying this today on Michael Court's show, that when you look at the photos that I'm pointing, Jesse Jackson had on a turtleneck and I think a leather jacket or something. And Jesse said himself that he was down in a yard or something. And he said that Dr. King hollered over to him, asked him, aren't you going to put on a shirt and tie? He said, Doc, the only thing required for dinner is not a shirt and tie, it's an appetite. But from my understanding, I don't know for sure. That's why I want people to check. He was supposed to have showed up on the Today Show on Friday, April 5th, 1968. He's supposed to have on a white shirt with blood on it. And as if to say that Dr. King died in his arms, that was a lie. Dr. King was in the arms of Ralph Abernathy. And Ralph Abernathy was holding on to him, saying, come on, hang in there, Mike. That was he used to call him Mike. That was his real name. And this guy Pepper said recently that a doctor from the Memphis Mafia said, make sure you get that nigga at my hospital because I'll make sure he won't come out there. And this doctor was supposed to be seen putting a pull over Dr. King's face and pulling the breathing tube out. Now, I don't know for sure. I'm just going by what William Pepper said, but I made the point today on Michael Kors' show that every time Jesse Jackson ran for president, I never seen or remember Coretta Scott King or family supporting Jesse. You know, and if Dr. King had powder burns on his face when he got shot, then he was shot at close range. Somebody on that balcony shot him. And that's one of the reasons why I tell people, I have that book, and the walls came tumbling down by Ralph Abernathy. It's a good book, but they didn't want that book to get out. The stuff that was going on, that the man was completely sold out. It's like Jesus had his Judas, Martin had his Judas, every black leader had a Judas around him. Could this DVD that Mark Lane and Dick Gregory did, on the DVD, they mentioned this paper called A Memphis Commercial Appeal from March 1992. And the title of the article was that for 75 years, Army intelligence spied on black leadership. It said it spied on Martin Luther King Jr., on Martin Luther King Jr.'s father, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s grandfather. And it said that they took an old Army base, Fort McCullen, they opened it up, and they took the Ku Klux Klan there and showed them the proper use of 30-06, the rifle that was supposed to have killed Dr. King. But see, the thing about it, I heard today on Senator Hughes' show come on Sunday, interview that was better than the speech he made about why I opposed the war in Vietnam with Sandy Van Oker from NBC News. And Dr. King rocked it, man. He broke down the economics out. They're going to tell black people to pull ourselves up by the bootstrap. We don't have no boots. They gave white people millions of acres of land that came over here. And we've been over here. Came over here as black people have held in slavery. And we didn't ask to come here. And you see how they sent us out after slavery was supposed to end it and sent us out with nothing. So we had nothing. That's why we're in the condition we're in today. And I mean, if you can get a copy of that, it should be on YouTube or somewhere. But you should check that out, man. But this crap that's coming up tomorrow, it's a joke. Because, like I told Michael Ford today, and I told Dr. Mackey yesterday, and Samari the other day, that number one, all right, they give you suits and room tomorrow. We came over here from Africa, they gave us shackles and chains and a bag to put the cotton in. You already had a job. So this is nothing new. We did a day of service. We've been doing a day of service for over 400 years and never got paid. It was going to be a day of service and set it up for black people to get employed. Let it be like a day of African black people, like we did with the Million Man March. Let us redirect our dollars that day into Afro-American business and support our own people. Let it be a real day of Africa. Let it be a real day of service that we serve ourselves, serve our community, and each day, let it be, in each day, year, let it be something different that we do in terms of business. Just like I first went up to New York, Malcolm's grave, back on Saturday, May 19, 2001. So when we came back, went to Harlem, 125th Street. I had my church and stuff. I go there, set up, make money. So I'm marching with them. But they tell everybody, shut the stores down. So they shut the stores down. So this is how to get in the store. Like 125th Street, like it was downtown Manhattan. I think it was Gap on there. One of them trying to get in. So this is told them, if you had a store, I would support you. And I thought, I said, y'all been coming up here, going to Malcolm Graves, doing the same routine, shutting stores down. Malcolm was about economics. If you had opened up a business every year, made a concerted effort to open up a new business every year when you come back, when Malcolm Graves said, you had 40 to 50 businesses up in Harlem that black people support instead of going to these major stores up here on 25th Street. But they were backwards, man. I don't care what anybody says. We as black people, we got the money to support our own, to give ourselves reparations for this white devil giving. What do I mean? Look at 2002, when you had the NBA All-Star game here in Philadelphia. That idiot Allen Iverson spent $40,000 to $50,000 written out in the gallery for a damn party. He could have took that money and open up two or three mom-and-pop stores, start putting our young brother and sister to work. By now, he might have had 100 or 200 mom-and-pop stores throughout Philadelphia and employing a lot of brothers and sisters that are out in the street selling dope. Just on the strength of his name, he could have made money, not only in Philadelphia, but in New York, they love him, down Virginia, where he came from, the Washington, D.C. area, Baltimore. All of them down the East Coast. He could be a billionaire by now. But they said the Negro's damn near broke. Be stupid. And look all of that. That money. Billions of dollars. They can invest in the black community. And we can build our own. There's no way in the world that the mom and pop stores in our community should be owned and operated by the Arabs, the Chinese, the Dominicans, the Irish, the Italians, the Jews, the Koreans, the Pakistanians, the Russians, the Polish. We should have our own stores in our own community. There's nowhere in hell you can go down Chinatown and show me one black business down there that's selling them Chinese soul food, chitlin chow mein or hog maw fui on pig foot pepper steak. They won't support you. They got enough sense to keep their money in their pocket to support only people who look like them. And just like now, we have no Afro-American community. We got 21st century Negro reservation. And just like that, when that old so-called Indian reservation, the white man gave the Indian firewater, they giving us firewater through the damn stop and go. And my thing is, if you want to bash Donald Trump, then damn it, start right here in Philadelphia if all politics are local. It's not Donald Trump that justifies your neighborhood. It's not Donald Trump that got these stop-and-goes set up. It's not Donald Trump that's bringing these people in, foreigners in, to take over the economy in your community. It's these Negroes down City Hall. They're the ones that are doing it. There's no way in the world. How in the hell are the Chinese do I have any representation in City Hall? But they got more power than us when it comes to economics. Every black neighborhood got two or three Chinese restaurants in it. Everyone.
Two or three?
Yeah, or 100.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for your call, bro. Thank you for your call.
You're welcome, bro.
Richard?
Yes, sir.
What did he say? Pig feet pepper steak.
Yeah, I was like, that court, he put it together.
Chitlin Charmaine, what the hell? Let's go to 646.
Yeah, what's going on, Brother Richard and Elliot? Listen, your last caller, what more can be said, man? I think I tonight may have to just drop the mic, man. I can't follow up with nothing other than what that brother said, man. He just pointed out what the problem in our community is, man. We serve everybody else except for ourselves. We let everybody else come in our supposedly communities and become rich, man. And then, you know, we want to big up, you know, individuals that done been dead for 50 years. I mean, yeah, I love Malcolm. I love Martin Luther King. But to be honest with you, I'm sick of hearing about them. Why haven't we produced someone to follow what they laid down? Why haven't we evolved on their so-called mission to free our people? I mean, I had to laugh when Little Joe was talking about Martin Luther King was radicalized by Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. I mean, to me, that's like funny BS. You know what I mean? The man wasn't radicalized by them two individuals. Yeah, he may have met with them, but they didn't do anything of no significance to change his ideology. The cracker did that for him, the way they was treating our people, the way they was going about the business of war and all of the other things that these dirtily, dastardly bastards are involved with even to this day. Ain't no Elijah Muhammad and no Malcolm X changed that man's political stance to the point to where he became so totally different. That's Negroes trying to feel good about individuals. You gotta stop trying to feel good about individuals. You telling me you changed the ideology and the thinking of Martin Luther King, and you got hundreds of crazy Negroes running around at that time, and Negroes today running around at this time with the message to the black man out there, books and lectures by Malcolm, and the Negro still as crazy today as he was 50 years ago? Stop with that nonsense and figure out how we can lead ourselves out of this madness. Stop and figure out how we could have sovereignty for ourselves and forget about the direction that Martin Luther King so-called was leading us in, that Malcolm was leading us in, and Elijah Muhammad was leading us in. Why don't we figure out how the hell we can lead ourselves out of this madness and stop looking in the past and look to the future and figure this thing out? I mean, the man just told you earlier how Bloomberg lied to you, how Biden lied to you. You know what I mean? I mean, ask yourself this simple question. If you're a clear-thinking, rational black man and woman, how the hell could you vote for Joe Biden? How the hell could you vote for any of them? I mean, if you check their track records and their relationship with black folks, how could you justify voting for them? Seriously, if you look at what Bloomberg done did to black folks in New York City, why would you, other than something mentally wrong with you, vote for that devil? What gives you justification in your mind to vote for him? What gives you justification in your mind to vote for Biden? I mean, could either one of y'all give me an answer in regards to what justifiably gives you the right to vote for them two bastards?
Well, no. Richard?
I have no rationale for it. Let me say this.
Like they gonna do something for you?
Well, let me say this on that matter. I do agree with you about the rationale of voting for any of them, but some of our people that don't do any research on what's going on, that have no clue to what they're dealing with or what they're up against, when they see, for example, what's that governor? Not governor, the mayor of Atlanta. No. When they see the mayor of Atlanta, what's her name? Keisha Bottoms or whatever.
Yeah, Keisha Bottoms.
When they see her as Biden's national co-chair, when they see the young lady sister that used to be on MSNBC or whatever, had the short cut hair.
Sanders.
Yeah, when they see her as his spokesperson, and I think somebody can clear me up. I think Cedric Richmond is one of his national co-chairs, if I'm not mistaken. When they see these people out there as national co-chairs and they're popular among the black community, then they follow like sheep. Some of our people have been sheep. It's no time to be sheep. That's how you get led to the slaughter. That's how wolves get you if you're sheep. Our people got to stop being sheep. They listen to too many reports.
And those three individuals, when they get in a position of authority or so-called power or so-called visibility, they don't do nothing for black folks but talk rhetoric. That's all they do. Is talk rhetoric. Now, I mean, my thing is this. The only solution I see is this. Is us, if you're going to deal with this whole political thing is, you got to just go local. You got to just deal with someone, hopefully, that's local, that's radical enough, that's willing to stand up and act and behave like a Charles Barron. I don't know who they have in Philadelphia that's willing to stand up and cause some hell and challenge white folks. I mean, I don't even think that type of politician is out there anymore. It's just like everything, and I may be wrong, but it seems like everything that we're trying to do as a people is nothing more than integrate ourselves into whiteness. To try and get white folks to treat us better, to accept us. And listen, man, white folks ain't never gonna do that. I mean, if the truth be told, white folks is losing their usefulness for your black ass. They don't even want you no more. They ain't trying to do anything to help you. If you look at any and everything in the direction of this country, all it does is show you that they trying to decimate everything in regards to poor people in the middle class just dying civilly. They trying to take care of Social Security, Medicaid, every chance they get, they want to take care of something that will just allow you to survive. And think about it. They don't give a damn because they hurting their people more than they hurting us. That's the crazy thing. They willing to hurt their people to hurt us in a sense that they don't even have the common decency to want to protect their own grandmother and grandfather. Because it's one thing. They done destroyed our family to the point now to where, if the truth be told, we don't even take care of Big Mama and Big Papa the way we used to.
Yeah. I agree with you.
We really in a serious, serious quagmire and fix in regards to how we're going to move forward in this country as a people. Because believe me, you're trying to integrate with your former slave master and your oppressor ain't done a damn thing for you and ain't going to do a damn thing for you because they basically don't have no use for you. And the sad thing is, they ain't even trying to look out for their own. That be the thing that always kill me, because whenever you say to one of these numbnuts, well, you hurting black folks basically hurt your own, whether you continuously do it. And they never have an answer for it, because in their mind, they don't feel like they hurting their own, because they live under the assumption that they white and they're going to be all right. But the people in Kentucky and other boondock states like that, they ain't seeing that way. But there's sickness within their mind of their racial superiority allows themselves to get effed over. And that's the tragedy of it. How do you allow a bastard like Mitch McConnell to ever stay in office? A dog like Lindsey Graham ever stay in office? Now, I'm going to tell you this. They got a black man running against Lindsey Graham. And I'm going to say this right now. If black folks allow for Lindsey Graham to get back in office, the only person you need to blame is dumb Negroes and crackers. Now, if you don't want to stand up and do that, just like you better blame them, you better blame white folks for Fredo Trump getting back in office in November. But Fredo getting back in office, I'm taking all bets on that, brother. I'm taking all bets on that, and I'm a betting man. So I have no problem with that. But if you allow somebody like a Lindsey Graham to get back in office, there's something fundamentally wrong with you. Because here's the case study of the most wishy-washiest racist white man there is. He can't even come out and be a man and say that he's a homosexual. He can't even come out and be a man and say he's a homosexual. And everybody know he a monkey man, twisty sister. I got more respect for Buttigieg than I do for that closet homo. But every time you turn around and you see this dirtbag on TV, he justifies the actions of Fredo. And I mean, this whole impeachment thing, oh, God have mercy. This is going to be one of the biggest farce in the world, man. This is gonna be an embarrassment. I mean, and watch the spin. The spin that's gonna come from these three major networks. It's gonna be incredible. I'm going myself, I think I'm gonna listen to NPR maybe and the Young Turks to see what they gotta say about this. Because I already know what Fox gonna say. I know what MSNBC gonna say. And I damn sure know what CNN going to say. I want to hear something alternative. And I don't know where I'm going to really find it. Because this is going to be one of the most beautiful dog and pony shows I think we will ever be able to witness in a long time, Richard and Elliot. And it's going to be on live TV, baby. And all I can do is say this. If there are no witnesses in this impeachment, if Bolton is in there, they could even give Biden and his son. They could come and testify. If Tejas is not testifying, if people who know what really went on with this whole thing don't get a chance to testify, then I know it's a fix going on. Because I'll say this, and I'll leave it with this. If the Democratic Party doesn't take advantage of this gift that's given to them and put forward the right narrative, we're in trouble as a people. Fredo going to get back in. But it has to change the narrative, man. If we don't change the narrative and expose it and doing something to change the mind of these sick crackers, it's going to be a wrap for us. I'm sorry to say it, Richard and Elliot, because if he gets another term in office, oh, man, our kids will never survive this. I don't see how people will survive it, because believe me, the thing that he's done that's going to affect our children for the future is what he's done to these courts. These courts are just going to be absolutely a breeding ground for white supremacy. And think about this. The brother that just got out of jail this week, Delvin Africa, he did 41, 42 years in jail, and luckily he got out. Think about it. 41, 42 years. Most of the MOVE members did 40 years and longer. And who was responsible for bombing that house? Who was responsible for allowing to happen with them, happen to them, a black man? And what did that tell you? Do anybody ever hear anything about that Negro? Where is that Negro at now? He's still alive, ain't he?
Oh, yeah, he's still around.
Okay, now I never hear anybody talk about the Negro or anything like that. What is the Negro doing? Is he in some college teaching, or is he just sitting on his behind collecting that pension check and coming out every now and then? Or hopefully he got dementia or Alzheimer's and he's going to have him a slow-ass death. Well, what's the deal with that joker?
No, he's a minister, so he goes around to churches and speaks.
Oh, he's a pork chop chicken eater? God have mercy. That right there questions Sky Daddy to its highest level. How could you do with them what you did to those men and women and have the nerve to be a pork chop chicken eater? And did you expect me to believe and anything that you say with what you did to those men and women, and now all of a sudden you a man of God? Have you repented for what you did to those men and women? You think that bastard repented for what he did to those men and women to allow them to be bombed?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Yeah, well, imagine you sitting down and watching that Negro stand over you talking that pork chop chickenism. Oh, man. Unbelievable. He's a minister. Lord have mercy. I would love to talk to him one day about the Sky Daddy. I would like to know, do he think what he did to them men and women, that the Sky Daddy will allow him into the pearly gates? Well, listen,
thank you,
brother.
Go ahead.
As always, I thank you, Brother Elliot. I thank you, Brother Richard. But I would really, really, at some point in time, want to know, when are we going to move forward in our development and growth as a people without looking for the past to be what our future is? Why can't we take the examples that we learned from the past and build upon them and provide a better future for ourselves? You can't tell me, and I want to know, how is it, and I really want somebody one day to explain to me, is how is after 50-some years of the passing of Malcolm and Martin Luther King, we haven't evolved in leadership nor position to elevate present-day individuals to the same status that we did them? That shows a lack of growth, to be honest. We got to be truthful about it. But listen, Elliot, put me on hold till the end of the show, and y'all have a beautiful week, my brothers.
Take it easy now.
All right, take care.
Richard, before we wind it up, let me, can you hear me? I do want to say something in reference to what Jay, the caller, just stated about our development since those men have passed. You know, I think our development has not been left just to us. It's been other people that have been scheming to retard our development. And we were talking about them with Brother Omawale. If black people's self-development was just left to themselves, who knows what could have been done since those men were taken off the scene. But it's been other forces to make sure our development is retarded. And a lot of those forces look just like us. We have to come to grips with that and deal with it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Yes, you're right. As Jay and you were saying that, I'm looking at, you know, just the how this manifests itself around the and I'm thinking, and with having a discussion with Brother Omawale, it's because of the fear. And one thing that I'm maybe a little disagreement or maybe just saying something to be saying something, I think in general, black folks in general was afraid 50 years ago, or the ones that we're looking at. And the ones we're looking at, if we're looking at political, what I call political entrepreneurs,
mm-hmm.
they were afraid 50 years ago and they're more afraid now. And I say more afraid, and that's saying that there's now two generations of political entrepreneurs, and it's more of them. And why I say they're more afraid now, I'm just going to use the example, and you know, from that news item of, you know, that what was that this week, the black women prosecutors went to St. Louis to support the prosecutor there and dealing with the court system and putting criminal charges against St. Louis.
Okay.
And how black women's prosecutors stood in support, and each one of them who are going, and the one I have to say, her husband gonna beat me up, but I'm in love with is the one from Baltimore, Mosley. If this is not a blatant, you know, when I say that, afraid, the political entrepreneurs and maybe even the general black community, when we talk about King and we talk about Malcolm, and we talk about our condition, we're talking about the movement that we're not making as a people. And the question is, why? Yes, it could be our mind, but it's definitely our fear, because you can't have a more blatant example of women who are going up against the system itself and the police system specifically, the ones who got those MOVE members in prison for 40 years. It was the police union. And here are these black women going up against the police union, and we got zilch in commentary, in rallying, in even just understanding from people of the courageous thing that they're doing, going up against that FOP, that police union, that court system, that has been housing, almost a fifth of black males, or maybe one-third, two-thirds of black males, the court system and the prison system is housing. And here is women coming up against it, and it's quiet. 50 years later, I mean, quiet. That we would rather talk about some, you know, fat boy who, you know, we know is a pervert and a criminal, but not really celebrate, support, I got your back, about women who's, even if they are integrationists, going up against the most vicious system that we know of that was put in place, and that is the police system and the court system to corral and control Black people. So I just when I look at that, you know, it is, you know, like having people like Brother Omawale and what they're doing, young, you know, people, you know, that's out there. Yes, that's the hope. But we see signs of where we're not really open to go in open warfare even now. We wasn't able to go in. I mean, King knew, Malcolm knew that they was coming after him. But as you always say, we didn't even deal with the collaborators then. And they were right there.
Well, and listen, if you want to speak on collaborators, and it's been a lot of speculation about King's inner circle.
Right.
That inner circle influenced Black life in this country for the next 25, 30 years after King's death.
Right.
If you're talking about Andrew Young, if you're talking right. about Jesse Jackson, if right. you're talking about, what's his name, that's in Congress now, he got cancer. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Got beat up right. on the bridge.
Right.
See, all of those men, see, you can, that's why I'm saying, Richard, if we're not talking about dealing with people that have that look like us but didn't really have our best interests at heart, that was out front with the fist in the air and saying this and that, but then going behind the doors and making deals with other people, if we're not ready to deal with that, we can't put it all in the Black... John Lewis, thank you,
right.
Brother Otis. If we're not ready to deal with that, then we can't just put the onus on the Black community and say we haven't done anything since King died. It's been other influences out there that's been cultivated by other people that seemed like they were for, and I'm not talking about the people that was outright against the community, the Condoleezza Rice's, guy that's in the Supreme Court now, the other guy that's working with Trump, the doctor. You know, I ain't talking about those people that people can easily pick on and say, oh, he's a Tom, he's a traitor, he's a coon, whatever they want to call him. I'm talking about the ones that you think that was in your camp. From all of those men I just named up to Obama, all of them didn't have the Black community at heart. They had other people at heart. It was interested in other people that was foremost in their minds. They just happened to have Black skin, and they could sing Al Green in a church, sing Al Green at a NAACP convention and stuff like that. So, you know, when we come together, those are things we got to deal with. We got to deal with it. We got to look closely at some of the things. And the one thing I do disagree with Jay about, I don't think the people are trying to relive the past. I think they're looking at the blueprints of the past to direct our steps in the future. Anybody smart would do that. But we really have to really look at the past for what it was and formulate in our minds what should have been done or what could be done now. And that's why I raised that assertion about Harriet Tubman and the narratives that they're putting out about our ancestor. And we know the situation that she found herself in, the environment that she lived in, and what those people would do to get their hands on her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it just stands to reason that, she, you know, she did what she had to do in all cases. She didn't get there and I pray and get on her knees talking about I'm praying. She had weapons and she was prepared to use it, and I believe she used it because we know how our people was now and we know how our people was then. She knew what happened to Nat Turner. She knew what happened to Denmark Vesey and others that are nameless in history. She knew what happened to these people. Gabriel Prosser. She knew. She knew what she was up against. She was smart enough to be able to evade all these people and live to a ripe old age of, in her 90s. She did what was necessary. And that included getting rid of traitors. And I know it did. And anybody don't believe that she didn't, they're sadly mistaken. Yeah, I just you know, want to kind of throw that in there, because I, you know, when Jay mentioned that about the, you know, I didn't want to put the onus all on and just blame black people. It's been other forces involved that's trying to shape the narrative in our communities. And they still involved now. You see it happening. That's trying to shape your thought patterns, the way you think, and not necessarily us. Their focus now is on our young people.
Mm.
All this stuff, accepting LGBTQRXVW, all types of lifestyles and other things. They're trying to shape the minds of our children now, where this stuff is going to be accepted. You might object to it, but your children are accepting it. That's who it's targeted towards. They don't care whether you're rich or they ever accept that. They don't care. They figure in 25 to 30 years, you won't be around.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be others around, and you won't be there to direct their path anymore. See, that's where history and us looking back at history is a guide. If we're not familiar with history, we're going to fall for anything. We'll be easily led, easily directed. That's why when this man was selling people off different plantations, a troublemaker or whatever, they wanted people that they could easily control. So if you was a problem on the plantation, you kept running away, you kept getting other people to cause problems on the plantation, pick cotton slow, don't pull the amount of tobacco, whatever. They made sure that they sold you. And they sold you to captivity where it was almost the mortality was very low. Rice paddies, sugar cane plantations. They made sure they sold you where you was going to be penalized for your behavior. They didn't keep you on the plant. They wanted to keep docile people of our ancestry on these plantations where they could kind of easily control them. But it didn't always work. We know our people are resilient. It didn't always work. They tried. It didn't stop them from trying. Just like that a speech I read that Lincoln did to the first audience of what it was written in the document, colored people that came into the White House. And I think it was August of 1862, I think it was, wasn't it, Richard? And he...
I don't remember that exactly.
And he told them that he said, I'm happy to be able to talk with you because we need colored people like you that think like white people. You remember he said that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
And that hasn't changed. Europeans still want black people that think like white people. The thing is, we got to change our mindset. That's the key to us reclaiming our rightful position in this world and the salvation for our people. Before we leave tonight, to give out the lineup, it's been a little programming change, but we're going to move forward. It's different programming, too, new programming that'll be coming on within the next month or two on Time for an Awakening Media. But on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue and conversation on African Perspectives, and they air again Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. To 1 p.m. From 6 to 8 on Monday evenings, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. Every first and third Monday from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. Conversation Reparations and Cobra's program is on. And the third Monday, so they're on tomorrow. I got to check my calendar. Morning Show Conversation Reparations is on tomorrow from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. Warren Ballantyne is back from his hiatus, so his programs will start re-airing from 10 to 12 on Time for an Awakening every day. That's Monday through Friday. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. On Fridays, the new program with Sister Marcy, and I don't have the title of the program in front of me. She'll be on from 1 to 3 on Fridays at the Brother Oshie's program. She had her debut a couple weeks ago, but she had a death in her family, and she wasn't able to do her program last year. But she'll be back into rotation on Friday doing her program from 1 to 3 on Time for an Awakening. And Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Friday evening, this Friday on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. Oh, I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Fireman. to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. To save the children. To save the children.